Malcolm Honlein is with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call this the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
It's good to be with you, Nachum, as always.
Appreciate that. Tough week. The weeks, no matter when these terrible losses occur, doesn't really matter, but to begin the week after hearing what happened on Shabbos and over the weekend and a couple of different episodes last night, yet more news comes out of Israel regarding soldiers who were killed. The price is very high, as we know, and I really wonder, and I don't know if you have any insight into this, obviously, and this is more of a theoretical question, but I really wonder how much of this plays into the minds and eventual actions of those who are in charge, whether it's a prime minister or his special security cabinet, whatever the case may be, because it's obviously close to 9 months at this point. The losses are mounting. The families are suffering. Shivas are going on all over Israel this week. And it is remarkable to hear the parents, friends, relatives, rabbis of these fallen soldiers. It's unbelievable to hear how they describe the sacrifice that was made and how these soldiers understood the purpose of mission and how vital their role and their lives were for the future of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. 9 months later, Malcolm, can the leaders of Israel continue to allow this to sustain itself where losses continue to mount the way they are?
The answer is yes. Sustain itself. We're talking, well over 300 soldiers have been killed. I think you look at the total, remember 1,200 people killed on October 7th. And everybody in Israel is either related or knows one of the victims, one of the people, the Karbanos. In addition, over 2,000 soldiers have been wounded. So the impact is very great. Remember all the businesses that to a halt already now for many months, let alone the 80,000 who've been displaced in the north and the tens of thousands who were displaced in the south and all of the communities along the Gaza. People don't take stock of the sacrifice that the people of Israel are making every single day. I think it's superhuman. And when you see some of the frustrations that are being expressed, it's because it takes a heavy toll after 9 months. But the resilience of the people, especially the guys in the military, I've been down to Gaza. All you hear the guys saying is that they want to go back in. Guys who have been even wounded, visited in the hospitals, all they talk about is going back to their units because they saw firsthand the evil. They were there. We read the stories in... It becomes almost meaningless, that Israel found another weapons factory or a huge cache of weapons, rocket fired, scores of them in hospitals and in homes and in institutions. They see it every day. They know now what Israel was in Gaza and how long they had prepared for years for this buildup, let alone what exists in the north. And they know what's at stake. And we sometimes, I think, since we go about our normal lives then, and as devoted as people are to the hostages and to supporting Israel, it's the same. And I think that their resilience is because they know, Ein Brera, there's no choice. And we have to, I think, reorient ourselves. It's amazing how many shuls at every minyan say Tehillim, and we our minds and our hearts and the hostages are on people's consciousness, and the people have gone down to Nova exhibition, all that is a reflection of how they have internalized that it's not a distant war. But on the other hand, we are going to face, even if the war would end tomorrow, the rebuilding in Israel and the price, and when all of this has pulled up, it's going to be very great.
Well, I'm glad that you pointed out the, you know, the positive of the way that people around the world, and especially here in the United States, are keeping the hostages and the IDF soldiers in mind and praying for them. And those who actually, you know, realize that there's a war going on, as I've been speaking about all week, should be commended, because unfortunately, I believe on the religious right and the religious left in this country, there are plenty of people and certainly plenty of youngsters, if you ask them anything about the Middle East, wouldn't even know that there's a war going on. But all right, we don't need to debate that. Also, I think it's absolutely unconscionable that major gatherings of thousands of people take place in our community, Torah gatherings, and not one mention is made of Israel, the soldiers, or the hostages. I'm not asking you to get involved with this. I could fight this battle myself, but it really is unbelievable. And again, I acknowledge the positive that you're mentioning. It is remarkable. There are plenty of people and plenty of synagogues and groups that normally would not be this enthusiastic about being out there in support of the soldiers and the hostages, who in fact are doing it. But there are too many people and too many events that are going on in our community, especially here in the United States, where major gatherings happen and there's not even a mention of what's happening in Israel. You wonder if anybody has it on their mind at all. Okay, all that having been said, and I thank you for listening, is there in fact a tactical pause by the IDF on a daily basis? They announced it would happen, but there seems to be a debate if it's actually happening. Is there a tactical pause to allow for humanitarian aid? And is the status of the pier that the U.S. built as poor as is being reported?
So in regard to the pier, I think they're making another attempt to establish it, because I think the embarrassment and the expenditure of almost $500 million and having to tow it several times to Ashdod because of when bad weather strikes, that's the whole idea of the pier, was to offer an alternative route for people to countries to send aid through Cyprus. Very little aid was actually going through that route. And the aid that was delivered was actually delivered from the port, which was supposed to be the responsibility of aid agencies, including UN. The pier, though, will be reestablished now. They think that they have over some of the technical issues, but it's not a long-term solution. And it was a gesture meant in good faith to provide an alternative route for aid to go. You look at the pictures yesterday in some of the markets overflowing with food, that the trucks are backed up, not because Israel's backing them up, because the aid agencies can't transfer it fast. And we know how much corruption is. We know that they steal the stuff, the Hamas steals it and then sells it or gives it, takes it for its own leadership, and then the remainder they sell. The continues to flow in. Israel, the army actually announced a program to close one route every day for quite a few hours, daytime hours, so that trucks could go in, and that would eliminate the excuse that the international community of putting the onus on it. The prime minister came out against it, saying they hadn't been consulted on the program, probably because there was internal opposition. So I'm sure that they have a compromise where they are allowing the trucks in, but I don't believe the bottleneck is the major issue. It's the security, it's the access to the people and getting a distribution system by the agencies themselves that are servicing Gaza to bring the aid from the trucks to the people. There is plenty of food. There is no famine in Gaza. It doesn't mean there aren't areas where they have to walk a little bit to get to a place where food is being contributed. But I can't believe what the international community has been doing. And yet in the Sudan, where millions are starving, and in Ethiopia, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of refugees from the Sudan are in camps where there isn't medical, there's no medical services, there's no food, there's no real habitable conditions. And yet you don't hear anything. And none of these people are demonstrating for the Uyghurs, for the Rohingya, for Muslim populations, let alone for the African populations and others who are suffering. This is just targeting Israel, because it is the one Jewish state that has done more in response to the horrendous attack. And I hope people take note of what Israel uncovers. It shouldn't just become a statistic that, you know, a couple hundred missiles and rockets and things were fired, found here, more and more sophisticated stuff. This was all aimed to be shot at Israel's civilian population. And you see how much they invested when you have tens of tunnels that are two-way tunnels where you could drive a bus in and out at the same time. That's how big some of these tunnels are into Egypt, and that, you know, how much had to be built, which means clearly that authorities knew and people got paid off. And the infrastructure in the north, I can tell you, we've seen some of it, is even greater. There's virtually no home without a rocket room. Tunnels underneath the whole of southern Sudan, southern Lebanon. Right. And, you know, what Israel faces there, and there is a contained battle right now. They've been responding harshly. They've taken out a lot of the leadership, key operatives, but not the all-out war. I don't think either side really wants it yet. And the time will come when it'll become inevitable. But Israel has to finish first Rafah. It has to finish more of the mopping up operations in Gaza, which will continue in time. And then they can put all the focus that they should on the 150,000 missiles and many more sophisticated. You saw how they get drones through and how the infrastructure that Hezbollah has is great. But people should not be fooled by the bravado. Threaten to attack Cyprus, I think it's a sign of weakness, not of strength.
You know, it's funny that Yaakov Katz wrote about, I never even thought of this, and it's so obvious, about the Ben-Gurion doctrine about not fighting a war within your own borders. Obviously, the enemy on October 7th brought it into the borders of Israel, so that's an exception. But his reference, of course, and the reason he cites it is because of what's going on up north. This war has got to be fought in Lebanon, and not the way it's being fought with the evacuation of 100,000 people, as you just described. I mean, this is inevitable. I know people are afraid and worried, and I can only imagine, God forbid, you know, if what the parents of soldiers are thinking, those who are going to be deployed up north. But I mean, this is inevitable, right? I know you don't like making predictions, but now we're getting to a point where within the next 2-3 weeks, if we don't see a major offensive into Lebanon, then it's going to be puzzling what Israel's strategy is.
Well, I wouldn't set a time limit on it. By the way, just the one to initiate that policy or think of it, it's in the Chumash, Ki Teitzei LaMilchama Ayavecha, in the Parshas Ki Teitzei. Why? Because it says you have to take the battle out, that once you're fighting on your own turf, you're losing. So the Chumash is warned about how to conduct a war, but it says when you go out to war, meaning go beyond your battle borders, take the battle to the enemy, because when you're fighting already in your battle, it becomes a defensive battle in nature. So the need to keep this battle off of Israel's turf, and you see that they can still fire rockets from the south, and certainly from the north, there is a great capacity, plus what you have along the people don't talk about the Golan, where you have huge Iranian militia encamped, and they've been building it up, and we have others who are there that are sitting and waiting, and every once in a while you see that a raid takes to eliminate a shipment of weapons coming in or an attack. And even now we have drones coming from Iraq, from the militias in Iraq, that have come across Jordan or around to Israel. So it needs to have Iron Dome in every position. They need to have planes that can take down these drones, because some of them are laden with explosives. Others are doing spy work. And you saw the pictures they took of the Haifa port and other facilities in the north.
Yeah.
People think of, you know, this ragtag Hamas. It's not ragtag. They've been getting billions of dollars that they could spend almost limitlessly, building infrastructure, the tunnels, which are not just, you know, sandcastles. These are very sophisticated. And in the north, they're there as well. So Israel needs to take the action needs to take. It can't be hampered if they don't get the weapons they need, if they don't get the support and the international community. It's time to stand up. And I have to credit the United States after the threat on Cyprus moved Eisenhower and other capacities to back to the Lebanon, near the Lebanon border. We need to see more of that because that's a deterrent to others getting involved, particularly Iran, Syria, and forces getting involved. Israel can handle Lebanon itself, but if all of these others get involved, it can become very dangerous.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course on the beloved NSN app. Malcolm Honlein with us. Weekly update. What about the threat from Hezbollah, Nasrallah, someone in Lebanon, I don't know where it came from, that they could obliterate Israel's electrical grid in one fell swoop? You heard about that threat this week?
It's actually coming from people involved in Israel's electrical network and the businesses who said at a conference they have long threatened to be able to do this, but the fact that officials and people in position to know or supposedly to know were echoing and saying that Israel could last, I think he said, 3 days without the electricity. So it's a threat that is very viable, and Israel, I think, has built some redundancy, but certainly not enough. It's not something you can just wave a magic wand and all of a sudden you have secondary and tertiary systems. It's very involved, and we know that electricity has been cut off to some areas by virtue of hitting a transformer, hitting a power supply, part of the power supply system. It's a very viable threat, and one that Israel has to take into account in all its actions and in its defensive actions.
Yeah, I don't wish that the enemy pursue something like that, but I just wonder if they have that type of capability. I don't know why they wouldn't implement it. I mean, you know what type of time and resources Israel would have to spend in order to get things back up and running, and that, of course, would deter them from, you know, an immediate reaction militarily. I mean, if the enemy...
But you're assuming they didn't try. You assume these attempts to send missiles and to send drones across the border... All of these are preparation, and they're scouting, and some of them, of course, would have taken out additional facilities. But thank God, through Iron Dome and through the heroics of the IDF, they tanked most of it.
Is there any type of stall in terms of arms shipments to Israel? We're getting conflicting news reports about whether the United States is actually holding back its arms shipments to Israel or not.
Well, the Prime Minister this week made various statements indicating that the United States promised to lift the hold on any ammunition. The United States says there is no hold on ammunition except for the 2,000-pound bombs. And State Department, again, said that that's the only restriction that is in place. And you saw that the statements that he made, the one sentence out of the context of the full statement where he does thank the United States for all that is being provided. And he said that he expects we know that one ship with a lot of equipment equivalent of dozens of planes coming with equipment to Israel. So it's a murky situation. It's unfortunate to have public discussion of it. The only thing, though, that has been confirmed to being held up, and you saw some of the really tough statements that administration people made about not knowing what Netanyahu was talking about with it, that the, there is skepticism, of course, and we see that the mission at the 2,000-pound bombs, because they're concerned be used. They'll be used to defend Israel. They'll be used in circumstances where it's absolutely essential. Everybody said that Israel couldn't go into Rafah. There would be massive casualties. Look what they did, and look how they've conducted the war there, using pinpoint hits on targeted locations, taking out part of a facility and not the predicted cataclysmic situation. If they didn't, think of all the stuff that would remain and these huge tunnels uncovered, which is why they had to take the Philadelphia route, was to be able to get to all these rocket launchers to stop the importation of weapons and hopefully to be able to destroy it. Big tunnels that enabled them for years to bring in countless stuff. And it wasn't just military. They made billions of dollars in tax and charging for goods that were brought to the people. And all the aid money, the hundreds and hundreds of millions that came in every month to Gaza, the most per capita of any community in the world, any people in the world, was going to pay for it and pay for all of this infrastructure that we're discovering.
Reports this week about the number of hostages. Everyone has been speculating in terms of the percentage of the 120 that might still be alive. Something we saw this week used the number 50. Do you have any type of update on that?
I do not discuss that. I think it's a mistake. We have to work on the assumption that they're alive. I know it's based on some intelligence, but we know they get false intelligence also. Then they say that they don't know. Hamas says they don't know how many there are. We don't know where they are. We don't have access to them. So you cannot believe any of the information that comes from them. This comes from hostages who came out. There have been remains found. All of this will be revealed, you know, when it's, God willing, comes to an end. So I think the speculation, we have to work to get all of them, 120, no matter what, if they're alive or not, that they get towards Israel, that they come to burial in Israel, and closure for the families. But we have to pray that many, many more are alive than some of the speculation.
There was a meeting between the U.S. and Iran, a meeting between U.S. and Israel regarding Iran, an upcoming meeting that's been canceled. Is that a big deal?
So you're right. There was a meeting between the U.S. and Iran in Oman. High-ranking American official did meet with Iranians, but nothing came of it, from best that we understand. And anything you do with Iran is a mistake, because if people believe their backdoor, I mean, and our neighbors in the region think there's backdoors diplomacy going on and stuff, they're going to hedge their bets, which they do anyway. So the Iranians are moving ahead on every front. We see that they continue to supply. We see what's happened in terms of their nuclear program, finally admissions to stuff that we have talked about, I don't even know for how long, about how far they have advanced in the enrichment process, whether they moved on miniaturization of the weapon, which is one of the phases that you need in order to get uranium, enrich it to the level for weapons grade, which is 90%, and they're in the 80%, which means it's just a sneeze away. And the delivery system, we know they have the ballistic missiles because they fired them at Israel. And so all the components are coming together for a nuclear weapon. And they keep, NPR and others keep saying, well, there's a fatwa against it. A fatwa doesn't mean anything against it. A fatwa meaning a religious order by Khomeini that he doesn't want a nuclear weapon actually developed. They develop all the resources and everything, but no. Clearly they're on the path to having a weapon. And they're working with not only North Korea, but we believe now maybe with China and even with Russia. And with this new alliance that makes it between these parties, makes it even more likely. So Israel needs to have more of an approach to address this, to how to undermine the regime, which I think is still the best way to deal with this. The scientists in Iran are working on special materials, simulations, and we believe that they have, or there are reports that they have, the computer simulation program, which means that you can test the effectiveness of weapons without actually having an explosion. The United States does it, others do it, and we have to, so it's not necessarily something that you will see, but clearly they're ahead all the time on their nuclear program, and that poses threat, something that not Israel can't live with, but frankly, nor can any of the countries in the Gulf or others, that you will see it, the arms race, if it's not already on quietly, where others are getting or preparing to get the capacity, because nobody wants to be standing without any of this, without this, to face an Iran that has nuclear weapons.
Let's span the world and go to Paris, where boys have been accused and charged in an alleged anti-Semitic gang rape of a 12-year-old Jewish girl. What do you know about the governmental and media reaction in Paris and France about this episode?
Certainly insufficient. Insufficient all along in terms of addressing the anti-Semitism that is manifest, and we've had murders. Remember two elderly women and the Halimi case of the young boy who was tortured and killed. And the government, you know, issues the pro forma statements being the kind of action. And while Macron can once in a while come up and say something or denounce the anti-Semitism, the fact is that they have lost control largely, as has Belgium, as has other countries, where these demonstrations go on virtually unchecked, where you have the growing, the growth of the Islamist communities in these countries taking over mosques, spreading their influence, defying governmental thing, establishing Sharia law in different places. And this is a process, I think, for 20 years I've talked about on this program, warning that this was happening. None of this should have been a surprise. And it comes to the point where you cannot reverse it. And the reflection of that is how well Le Pen is doing, the extreme right parties are doing and did in the European elections, the EC elections, where right-wing parties, extreme right-wing parties in many cases, were very successful, because it's a reaction of the people facing this reality, and the unlimited immigration that has taken place compounds it. So, you know, we see every once in a while some gesture. Canada listed the IRGC finally as a terrorist group. I mean, it's years of pressure that has been placed trying to get this recognition under this criminal code. What would have stopped them? They didn't know this a year ago and 2 years ago, and they say that Canada says that this will send a message. It's going to use all the means at its disposal to combat the terrorist entity. This is 20 years making in Canada, and certainly in Europe, where it's even much more sophisticated and widespread, and the infrastructure of a massive population. You saw in Brussels, more than 50% of the people expressed anti-Semitic attitudes, and because you have that percentage of a Muslim population there.
Yeah, we know that anti-Semitism is always the answer to everything when it comes to the political situation. But in all seriousness, I wasn't really kidding when I said that, but in all seriousness, I meant to ask you this last week about the EU elections. I mean, the reality is that if the country is under the impression, or the continent is under the impression, that certain policies are, you know, ruining the future of the country or of the continent, what do you expect? Of course they're going to react by voting the other way. And that's exactly what happened here. It sounds like, you know, it sounds like the normal panic that Jewish leadership might have had for the way the EU elections went. It sounds like it's sort of just admitting that, you know, this was inevitable because of, you know, the political situation and the way things were going.
It is expected, and maybe the numbers were greater than what they anticipated. And right. Macron, as you know, called snap elections. Britain's having elections. We have others, and we'll have to see what the outcome could be, where you could see Labour come back to power in England. but to recognize the absurdities that are going on in the political process when gays march for Hamas, not even taking into account the fact that they wouldn't dare even raise their in Hamas lands or controlled lands or Hezbollah controlled lands, or the what they do to religious minorities, what they do even Islamic ones, that the demonstrations are such a distortion and a generation being raised on these, not only in the Muslim communities where this indoctrination of the young has gone on steadily, where they have in their own schools teaching anti-Semitism, including still in the United States, let alone what we're seeing in the public schools and on the university campuses. And despite the actions that are being taken, which are very important, it's still only scratching the surface of how embedded this has become in our academic circles.
And sometimes it's interesting to watch what's not being done, like the Manhattan DA, who will not be prosecuting the students who protested at Columbia. And he made that very clear.
It is such an outrage. And I hope that the names will be made public, at least that people, employers in the future will know who participated, that there has to be a price for it. And if the legal system can't provide it, then we can find other legal ways to name and shame the people who espouse these kind of views, because a potential employer would not know that the people have such hateful and bigoted views. It's like saying that if somebody was a member of the Klan and we're not going to reveal it, and somebody, the people will hire them. And I think it's disgraceful, and it undermines the whole system of justice in America, even beyond this particular issue.
Yeah, well said. A week from today is the Iranian election, right? Is it a week from today? Am I right about that?
27.
So yeah. A week from yesterday. And speaking of spanning the world and elections, could you give us a definitive answer if the new president of Mexico is Jewish or not?
Oh, no, she's definitely Jewish, Sheinbaum, but she's not sympathetic. She's actually very left and has expressed some harsh views. I don't think she was supported by many in the Jewish community, but she is definitely of Jewish origin. And but you see the picture of her with a keffiyeh wrapped around her and other things that are indicative of some of the views that she has expressed.
So we're not anticipating Mexican support in the immediate future?
I would not anticipate a major shift in their policy in this regard.
I saw that Israel has approved a whole bunch of permits for foreign workers to come in. We know how important, especially now, as you described, so many of the businesses have to literally get off the ground again and bring in foreign workers. Are the people from Thailand, it seems like that's where the majority are going to be coming from, are they ready to come back to Israel, or were they completely scared off by the episode of October 7th?
No, I think people are ready. That they had into India, by the way, I think will be a major source for tens of thousands of employees to come in, but they all have to be vetted, right, and reviewed. They don't just round up people and, you know, they line up, sign up, and come to Israel. They have to be vetted that they're not involved in the terrorist activities. But I think it's very important that these workers come for construction, because I still think that there will be a big aliyah is over. There has to be a lot of reconstruction in the south and in the north. Many hundreds of homes have been severely damaged, and some of them irreparably. We don't read the accounts because there aren't casualties per se, because people aren't living in those homes. Right. But Hezbollah has been targeting them and doing a lot. Those communities will all need to be rebuilt. The businesses will need to be rebuilt. So we're going to need a lot of foreign workers to come in and do this while the people engage them, while people are mobilized. So I think it's going to be for a positive reason, because I still believe that from Europe you'll have big aliyah, and I believe from America, despite all that occurred, I think a lot of people have come to the realization, Central Israel, to their lives, about what the reality of the situation here is, and that will be reflected in people buying and making half or full aliyah.
Now that the last Jew in Yemen has passed away, is it time to consider rebuilding the Jewish community of Yemen, Malcolm?
It's not the last Jew. There are five others still there. This is the oldest Jew. He was 101 years old. He lived in a, alone in a community. He had been offered opportunities to get out, but he didn't, and it was his Muslim neighbors that buried him. But the level of hatred against Israel, Jews, has grown. It's really vicious. The Jews who are there live on a compound that sort of is a protected area. There is absolutely no reason and no possibility to rebuild the lives. There is, unfortunately, Levin Rari, who's still in prison, and despite all the efforts to get him out so far unsuccessful, they arrested him because he was involved in the transfer, if you remember, of a safer, I think, unfortunately, was shown that they brought to show Netanyahu, and, of course, it got publicity in Yemen, and they arrested this young man for his involvement in it. There's a long history of the Yemeni Jews, not a very glorious one for many years. And I think, although the traditions in the community itself was remarkable, they were an Operation Eagle and Wings of Eagles and others in 48 and later on. And then, unfortunately, some did not leave. The hatred and the demonstrations, not just against Israel, but against the Jews as well. You know, the Houthi flag says, death to America, death to Israel, curse God, curse the Jews. That's on their flag. So, no, I don't believe there's going to be any rebuilding of the community.
the address by the prime minister in Washington, still the 24th of July?
Yes, and the 24th of July is still on the 24th of July, yeah, as far as I know.
I would figure.
But they're still subject to change. I'm not saying that there's any indication of a change. But unfortunately, so Nancy Pelosi is saying that she's encouraging people not to attend.
Yeah,
and
boy.
Senator Warren and the usual suspects getting up there and making saying they're not going to go. I hope that the vast majority will go and should write their members of Congress to make sure that they go. That this is, it's not whether you like Netanyahu or anybody else. It's about the strength of the U.S.-Israel relationship and the message that we stand together in a war against terrorism, because it's our war as well.
Do you assume, I'm being serious, I'm not facetious, do you assume Senator Schumer won't go because of the statements he's made publicly about Bibi, or he's officially one of the inviters of the prime minister?
No, he will go, I'm sure. He is an inviter among the four leaders that extended the invitation, so he will go. I think if he wouldn't, a lot of the criticisms and things that are being expressed will be magnified a thousandfold.
And certainly well-deserved. Malcolm, I thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week.
God willing, be well. I'll be in Israel, so hopefully we
fantastic.
Can get it.
Fantastic. Thank you. If I get there by next Shabbos, I'll let you know. We'll do the show together in Jerusalem. Malcolm Honlein, he is, of course, responsible for our weekly update every single week here at JM in the AM, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Make sure to be tuned in every single week. And the archive becomes available really quickly, by the way, so which I think people have already discovered. Based on the reaction I'm getting to the archive and the archive that acts as a podcast, it's obvious that many, many people realize that it's available almost immediately after the show. Thank you, Avrami.